It's Monday, the 13th of May, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Over the last several weeks, there has been a building controversy over the issue of the emergency contraceptive and its availability not only to women over the counter, but also to young girls. The background of this, of course, is that a federal district court judge for the Eastern District of New York State had handed down a decision a few weeks ago saying that Plan B, the emergency contraceptive, had to be released available to women or to girls of any age without restriction, without prescription or supervision. This has led to a great deal of controversy, and that controversy takes us last Friday to that same district courtroom in the Eastern District of New York State where Judge Corman denied the government's request for a stay of his decision. The background of that has to do with the fact that Health and Human Services' Kathleen Sebelius had handed down a new policy on behalf of the HHS and the Food and Drug Administration. That policy, according to the Obama administration, would lower the age of unrestricted availability of the emergency contraceptive from 17 to 15. Judge Corman's decision would lower that age to no restriction at all. In other words, the drug would be available to women, to females, to girls of any age. Part of the background on this, as I wrote about at my website at albertmoeller.com last week, is the fact that there are those who are hiding their agenda behind the word science and who are also sneering at parents because parents are clearly seen to be part of the problem rather than the solution. The sexual revolutionaries who believe that teenagers will have sex and even ought to have sex and thus are due the right to have an unrestricted availability to the morning after pill, they see parents as the problem, as impediments to their own children's expression and the exercise of their rights. Of course, these same children could not get an antibiotic pill without a parent's permission. But the morning after pill, the sexual revolutionaries and the progressives in our society say it has to be put into a completely different category. In handing down his decision on Friday not to issue the stay, Judge Corman, that is Judge Edward R. Corman of the United States District Court of the Eastern District of New York State, said, quote, "If a stay is granted, it will allow the bad faith, politically motivated decision of Secretary Sebelius, who lacks any medical or scientific expertise, to prevail, thus justifiably undermining the public's confidence in the drug approval process." End quote. A couple of things to note very quickly here. First of all, this judge accuses the Secretary of Health and Human Services of lacking any medical or scientific expertise. The same, we might note, is true of the judge who wrote this decision. He also writes that the federal government's demand for a stay, if granted, would, quote, "undermine the public's confidence in the drug approval process," end quote. How does he know that? And what confidence is he concerned about there? It's not the confidence of parents who make up so many citizens. It's the confidence of those sexual revolutionaries who believe that the emergency contraceptive should be made available to women and girls of any age. The other thing we need to note here once again is that the word girl is missing from almost all of the media coverage. An example of that comes from the Los Angeles Times yesterday and their story on the judge's decision to deny a stay. In the Los Angeles Times piece, the president of the Center for Reproductive Rights is quoted as saying, quote, "Judge Corman's sound ruling simply orders the government to do what the experts at FDA have been trying to do for years, to put politics aside and let science guide us to a policy that makes emergency contraception readily accessible to all women when they need it most urgently," end quote. Again, the controversy here, as related to the current issue, is not about those who are 21 and over or 18 and over, but rather those who are even now 15 and younger. In other words, girls. But you'll notice that the media and those driving this kind of sexual revolution insist on using the word woman or women in this context. They mean thereby to avoid the issue of girls. But try as they may, the reality is that Americans are catching on that what is being debated here is over-the-counter, unrestricted, non-prescription availability of Plan B, the emergency contraceptive, to girls as young as 10 or 11. Shifting to the issue of same-sex marriage, the state of Minnesota is set to become the 12th state to legalize same-sex marriage and the very first in the Midwest, and it may do so as early as today. As Brian Bask and Patrick Condon report for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the Associated Press, a pivotal vote Thursday, the Minnesota House positioned that state to become the 12th in the country to allow gay marriages and the first in the Midwest to pass such a law out of its legislature. The House vote was 75-59, a critical step, they write, for the measure, which would allow same-sex weddings beginning this summer. The Minnesota Senate is expected to vote on the issue as early as today, and the governor, Mark Dayton of Minnesota, has announced that he will sign the bill into law as soon as it arrives on his desk. This new development underlines the velocity of the moral change we are experiencing on the issue of same-sex marriage and the larger issue of homosexuality. The state of Minnesota just a few months ago narrowly defeated an effort to make same-sex marriage impossible by passing a constitutional amendment that would limit marriage in that state to the union of a man and a woman. We're talking about less than a year ago, and now it appears that momentum for the passage of same-sex marriage and its legalization in that state is almost unstoppable. The Senate is expected to vote in the affirmative today. The House having done so last Thursday, the bill will go to the governor of the state, Mark Dayton, and the marriage ceremonies for same-sex couples in Minnesota could begin as early as this summer. Again, one of the most significant things for us to note is the pace of this moral change. A pace of change that had been visible on the horizon for some time, but is now actually being lived out in the experience of states. In the Midwest, no state has yet voluntarily, that is legislatively, legalized same-sex marriage. In the state of Iowa, legalized same-sex marriage took effect because of the vote of judges in that state. But Minnesota will be the first in the Midwest by its legislature to legalize same-sex marriage. And that, both geographically and speaking of worldview, is no small thing. At the end of last week, another controversy arose, this one having to do with the Internal Revenue Service and its wrongful scrutiny of the Tea Party and other conservative political and values groups. As was reported in the Wall Street Journal at the end of last week, the Internal Revenue Service apologized for what it said were mistakes in targeting Tea Party and other conservative groups for extra scrutiny during the 2012 election campaign, but it insisted that its actions weren't politically motivated. Lois Lerner, head of the IRS Tax-Exempt Organizations Division, told reporters, quote, "We made some mistakes. Some people didn't use good judgment. For that, we're apologetic." Agency officials said the improper actions were taken by career civil servants, not by political appointees. But the controversy is continuing to roil, and the Wall Street Journal, that deserves a great deal of credit for breaking the story, reported just late yesterday that the Internal Revenue Service's scrutiny of conservative groups went beyond those with Tea Party or Patriot in their names, as the agency admitted on Friday, to also include ones worried about government spending, debt, or taxes, and even ones that lobbied to, quote, "make America a better place to live," end quote. That according to new details of a government probe of the Internal Revenue Service. But as this report from the Wall Street Journal came out late yesterday, the reporters also wrote the Inspector General's office has been conducting an audit of the IRS's handling of the applications process and is expected to release a report this week. The audit follows complaints last year by numerous Tea Party and other conservative groups that they have been singled out and subjected to excessive and inappropriate questioning. Many groups said they were asked for a list of their donors and other sensitive information, end quote. And then, on Saturday, the Washington Post reported this. Details of the Inspector General's audit obtained by the Washington Post from a congressional aide with knowledge of the findings revealed that Lois G. Lerner, who oversees tax-exempt groups for the IRS and made the disclosure Friday, knew about the targeting of Tea Party and other groups in June of 2011. In March 2012, IRS Commissioner Douglas H. Shulman told Congress that the agency was not targeting conservative groups that applied for tax-exempt status as social welfare groups, end quote. The worldview implications of this are huge, and yet people on both sides of the political and cultural divide tend, of course, to be far more outraged when the rights violated are their own or those of allied organizations. As Russ Douthat wrote in his op-ed column in Sunday's edition of the New York Times, other than the power to prosecute crimes, the power to tax is one of the most authoritarian powers held by any government. When that power is used maliciously, unfairly, injudiciously, or in this case, with an ideological targeting now admitted by the IRS, that certainly leads to a loss of credibility in one of the government's central functions. It will be very interesting this week to see how this story unfolds, but unfold it will in one way or another. This is one of those stories that people on both sides of the political and partisan divide cannot let alone or ignore, because complaints like this get to the very heart of the government's own integrity and the integrity of its taxation service. And, as Russ Douthat says, other than the power to prosecute, the power to tax is a demonstration of the most raw form of government power. If it is misused, it represents a very dangerous misuse of government power. Shifting to the issue of abortion, it is not often that one gains considerable insight into what individual justices of the United States Supreme Court are thinking about issues such as this, such as abortion, until they actually hand down a decision. Even then, it is sometimes difficult to know, given the way decisions are handed down, what an individual justice is actually thinking. We have an exception to that and an insight into the thinking of one of the justices when on Saturday, Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg gave a very interesting address at the University of Chicago Law School. As the Associated Press reports, one of the most liberal members of the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, could be expected to give a rousing defense of Roe v. Wade in reflecting on the landmark vote 40 years after it established a nationwide right to abortion. Instead, Ginsburg told an audience Saturday at the University of Chicago Law School that while she supports a woman's right to choose, she feels the ruling by her predecessors on the court was too sweeping and gave abortion opponents a symbol to target. Ever since, she said, the momentum has been on the other side, with anger over Roe fueling a state-by-state campaign that has placed more restrictions on abortion. The justice said, quote, "That was my concern, that the court had given opponents of access to abortion a target to aim at relentlessly." She said this to students at the University of Chicago Law School. She continued, quote, "My criticism of Roe is that it seemed to have stopped the momentum that was on the side of change," end quote. This is a very interesting assessment, but this is not the first time we have heard from Justice Ginsburg on this issue. Years ago, she made a very similar address in which she made the same points. That is, she felt that the court had overreached in the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973 and that it had actually set back the cause of abortion rights by creating a backlash to the Roe v. Wade decision that has continued to this day. Her argument is very controversial among abortion rights groups, but as this article indicates, Justice Ginsburg is both liberal, one of the most liberal members of the court, and an ardent defender of abortion rights. That's what makes her speech on Saturday actually more interesting. It's not so much what she had to say about Roe v. Wade in terms of creating a backlash. It's what she said to the students at the University of Chicago Law School she has not said previously. As the Associated Press reports, quote, "The ruling is also a disappointment to a degree," Ginsburg said, "because it was not argued in weighty terms of advancing women's rights. Rather, the Roe opinion, written by Justice Harry Blackmun, centered on the right to privacy and asserted that it extended to a woman's decision on whether to end a pregnancy," end quote. This is a very interesting argument. It's also perplexing to a degree, because even as Justice Ginsburg said she had wished that the decision that would make abortion rights universal, coast to coast, would have been written, quote, "in weighty terms of advancing women's rights," end quote. Where exactly in the Constitution would she have found that particular basis? She did not say. But the reason why Justice Blackmun wrote the decision in terms of the right to privacy is that that was the right available to him, a right that had been noted by the U.S. Supreme Court when it invented it, out of the controversy over the availability of contraceptives. What we're looking at here is a very interesting analysis from one of the sitting justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, but it is also a very revealing piece in terms of worldview. The way the Associated Press article ends is also extremely illuminating. It writes, quote, "Ginsburg told the students she prefers what she termed judicial restraint and argued that such an approach can be more effective than expansive, aggressive decisions." Quote, "The court can put its stamp of approval on the side of change and let that change develop in the political process," end quote, she said. Asked about the continuing challenges to abortion rights, Ginsburg said that in her view, Roe's legacy will ultimately hold up. Quote, "It's not going to matter that much. Take the worst case scenario. Suppose the decision were overruled. You would have a number of states that will never go back to the way it was," end quote. Well, Justice Ginsburg, you have to know, and she certainly does know, that before Roe v. Wade was handed down in 1973, the map of the United States was divided between those states that had legal abortion and those that did not. If you look at that map, it's almost exactly as predictable as you think it would be, with the states legalizing abortion, especially concentrated on the two coasts, especially the Northeast and the Northwest, along with California. In other words, what Justice Ginsburg seems to want to say here is that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided, both on its basis and in terms of its intent, especially its extent. But she goes on to argue that it wouldn't matter if Roe were struck down because, what she calls the worst-case scenario, you would have a number of states that would never go back to the way it was. Well, but Justice Ginsburg, the other side of that is also true. You would have a number of states that certainly would go back to the way that it was. Finally, there's been a lot of controversy in terms of our cultural conversation about the generation that won't grow up, those who should be classified as adults, but young people who are not moving into adult responsibility or relationships. This delayed adulthood and extended adolescence has caught the attention of just about everyone in the culture, from employers and educators, certainly also to parents. The Wall Street Journal had a major insert in its last weekend edition about young people who move back in with their parents. In other words, it has become such a major phenomenon that the Wall Street Journal, 2 weekends ago, decided that it had to put a special section in about how parents should think legally and financially about this new pattern. But in Sunday's edition, that is yesterday's edition of the New York Times, there was an article that leaves us simply scratching our head in wonder. The headline is this: "Hey Mom, call me when you find my wife." As Yi-Hyun Lee reports, marriage-minded websites have arisen to meet the needs of parents looking for their sons or daughters' ideal match. You heard that correctly. Parents looking for the match for their own children. We're not talking about a return to the kind of arranged marriages that took place previously. We're looking at parents going to internet sites in order to find prospective spouses for their children and in order to market their own children in terms of being a prospective spouse. Now, unsurprisingly, when you read this article, you find out that there is a gender pattern here. Most of the people doing the searching are mothers, and most of the people they are searching for are wives for their sons. The headline again was, "Hey Mom, call me when you find my wife." As the reporter writes, some parents think they are entitled to help choose a mate because the marriage is not only a union between a man and a woman, but also of two families. But the other problem here is that these young men in particular are not moving towards marriage, and now their moms have decided to give them a shove. But they're doing so in a rather technologically driven phenomenon now, going to the internet and to websites such as the jmom.com, intended for Jewish moms who are primarily looking for a wife for a son. One Jewish mother profiled on the site wrote this about her adult son, quote, "Bradley is energetic, motivated, enthusiastic, and if I do say so myself, an attractive young man. He is 5'10" with brown hair and blue eyes. Brad is hardworking and very outgoing." She goes on to say that these characteristics serve him well in his professional life. But the noted thing here is that this is a mom writing about an adult son. What does it tell us that this mom has to write about the adult son that he's supposedly outgoing? If he were outgoing, you would think he would be outgoing in a way that would catch the attention of some available and eligible female. But no, moms had to go to the internet for that. The bottom line in all of this, of course, is that the generation that won't grow up is a generation that's not going to get married, at least in terms of some of its members, until mom gets involved. And this story tells us more than perhaps we even wanted to know about the generation that won't grow up. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.